behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin. That is our super producer, Noel, which I guess makes this another episode of Car Stuff.
That's what it is.
Oh, I'm so glad we're in the right place. Scott, this is something that I came to you with because I think there's an amazing story in here.
I think you're absolutely right. And again, it's one of those things that I can't believe we've gone years without really focusing on this company.
Yes. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we present to you the history of the Honda Motor Company.
Maybe it's because we were scared of it.
Maybe
it's just a little bit. It's intimidating.
It's a lot to look at.
It's intimidating because, there's a rich history here. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot going on. You know, when we talk about the founders of companies, we always get kind of wrapped up into these extra little sidebar stories. And because the people that develop automobiles, the people that develop automobile companies, are typically, they're fascinating people, Ben. They've got so much going on in their life, as you would expect. I mean, it's not just like, you know, they get up and decide to do it one day. This is a lifelong passion with them. And such is the case with the founder of Honda.
Yes. Our story today begins with a fellow named Soichiro Honda, born in 1906.
Yeah, 1906. So that goes back pretty far, but the company itself doesn't go back that far. Now, Honda Motor Company, goes back to 1948. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's still around. So it's a company that exists today. Everybody knows that. I'm positive of that. But the way that we got from 1906 to 1948, there's a lot going on there. And I think that's what our primary focus is going to be on today. I mean, I know mm-hmm. that everybody probably wants to hear about, you know, the certain makes and models of cars that, you know, have done really well for Honda.
And we'll touch on that.
And some of the innovations along the way that have, you know, made, you know, the company, the brand really, really great, actually, because they're a manufacturer of engines and they do that very, very well, mm-hmm. as we'll find out. Mm-hmm. Motorcycles, automobiles, power equipment, they make
even
all kinds of stuff.
Solar power equipment.
They make just about anything and everything, really, that you can imagine. It's a huge, huge company, but it has a relatively humble beginning.
Yes, it has a beginning. The idealist in me here wants us to go to the beginning in terms of the first time Soichiro Honda decided that he wanted to be involved with cars.
We can do that.
Is that okay?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right.
How far back does that go?
Oh, man. Literally goes back to grade school.
Yes, second grade. He saw his first automobile when he was in second grade. And now this is in a little town. It's called Hamamatsu. I think I got that right?
Yeah, good job.
Hamamatsu in Japan. And he was at elementary school. And I think this was the first automobile to really, you know, enter his village, his city. Cars were extremely rare at the time. We've talked about that in the past, that, you know, this is the era when, you know, they just weren't around. They just weren't prolific. They weren't being built in such numbers that they were everywhere.
Right.
And so they were very rare. But the first one that came to his town, I mean, he was intensely interested in this thing, you know, as a young kid. Just fascinated with it, everything about it. They said, and I read somewhere or heard somewhere on some video clip, I've watched so much and listened to so much recently, I forget where this comes from. They said that, you know, where it parked, it had left a little pool of oil on the mm-hmm. ground. And they said that he was so fascinated with it, he went over to the little puddle of oil in the sand or whatever and scooped it up with his hands and brought it up to his face and kind of inhaled the oil and just was smelling like, what's this thing leaving behind? You know, what is this? What's this all about? And he was just that intensely fascinated with it. Like everything and anything about the automobile, he wanted to know about from that point forward.
And he stayed with this, I guess fixation is a fair word. We should know, as a kid, he was helping his father with a bicycle repair business.
Yeah. Yeah, so he had a fascination with things that were mechanical, right? I mean, was his dad was a blacksmith, I think.
Yes.
Also, and his mother was a weaver, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
She was like a, you know, would weave silks and things like that. But he was a blacksmith, so he had mechanical knowledge as well. And I guess this kind of, you know, drifted down to him. You know, he had interest in the same type of thing, bicycles, of course. Mm-hmm. Loved to ride his own bicycle all around. That was a common sight, I guess, was to see him on his bike. But he also knew once he saw that car, that this was the thing that was going to lead, you know, the world really into the next era. It was going to be, you know, the Industrial Revolution. That this was it. I mean, this is going to bring people together. It's going to allow people to move out into, you know, greater reaches of the country. It was going to allow you to travel. It was going to allow all kinds of different things, you know, transport of goods. He just knew that this was the invention that was going to do it.
And he didn't wait long to start chasing this. When he was only 15 years old, he left his town, mm-hmm. his hometown, and went straight to Tokyo to start working in a garage.
Yep, capital city. He went to the capital city of Tokyo, and he worked at this this company. It was called Art and Company. After graduation, now it's a mechanic shop, and you can imagine. I can imagine they weren't terribly busy, or maybe they were really busy. I don't know how to gauge this, Ben, because here's an auto shop. What year would that be? 15 years later, early 1920s. I don't know how busy it would be, but Tokyo's a busy city, so, you know, there might have been a lot of cars around there. He stuck around at this Art and Company for about 6 years, kind of learned his trade because, you know, this is where he's really getting hands-on with cars for the first time. And then he moves back to his own hometown of Hamamatsu, and he opens up his own, Art and Company branch, I guess, the Hamamatsu branch of Art and Company.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a big deal. I mean, to open up his own company at such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was only 21 at the time, right?
Right. He was 21, 22-ish.
Okay.
He's on the cusp.
All right.
And so, he continues working for this, but of course, although history would have us put some rose-tinted glasses on there, he didn't have the easiest time.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, things weren't going so well for him at the shop there. I mean, it was, I don't know if it was just a lack of business or what was going on there, but, you know, after a while he had acquired all these automotive skills and he decided, you know what, I'm going to start up my own company again. I'm going to start up, something called the Tokai Seiki Company. And that's in 1937. So, you know, this is still, he's given a pretty good go with his own automobile company or his own rather mechanics company, I guess the Art and Company thing.
Yeah.
And he decided that this Tokai Seiki company was going to produce piston rings. That was what he was going to build.
Right, piston rings for Toyota. And this is where we see a little bit of an uphill journey for him because originally these piston rings were rejected.
Yeah, well, and I'll tell you why, Ben, because he's not a precision engineer. He didn't have the education to do this the proper way. And I'm sure he thought he could, you know, with all this mechanical skill that he had. And he did, he was quite skilled at it, apparently. But he didn't have the proper machining skills, you know, the precision engineering edge that was necessary in order to make it in this company. So, because, I mean, piston rings are that's a vital internal component that, you know, if they're wrong, well, of course they were rejected. If they're wrong, they're just not gonna, it's not gonna operate the proper way. They have to be
right.
Exactly right. So he entered the Hamamatsu Professional School of Technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he kind of mastered the basics, worked as an auditor while he was doing that. So he had another job on the side.
Yep.
But he finally, was able to produce these piston rings of a much higher quality once he finished this education.
Right. And when we say, notice we say finish, not graduate, because mm-hmm. he didn't actually graduate. He just learned enough to figure out what he needed to improve, which I think, if you look back, and any stories of great inventors, that's kind of a typical thing.
Now that's pretty smart. See, he went in saying, I just need to know how to make piston rings better, and then he focused on what to do there, and then he got out.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Oh, I think it's smart. And by 1941, he was mass producing these rings, and he was employing people who were unskilled, which is a huge thing.
And during World War II, of course, you know, we've talked about this so many times, but you know, the all the production shifts over to the military. Angle, the military aspect of this whole thing, and he started producing piston rings for the military machines of the day, you know, whatever Japan's needs were at the time. And so his company started working day and night producing piston rings, and it was you know, of course a huge success for him. I mean, you know, it was a contract that lasted a long, long time. Unfortunately, didn't last all that long because the Tokai Seiki plant was actually destroyed by bombing in 1944.
Yeah, and after that, the plant in Itawa collapsed in an earthquake in 1945. One point I do want to make about the wartime. Yeah, he can't get a break.
Can I tell you, I mean, when I read that, I was like, what is going on here? He gets bombed, and then an earthquake hits and kind of finishes the job.
Yeah, and before that, if we can just go back a little bit, there's something that happens in the early 40s, which is just terrible for Honda here. Tokai Seki is under the control of the Japanese government at this time, the wartime Japanese government. And they were in peace. They were known as the Ministry of Commerce, but it became the Ministry of Munitions.
Oh, boy.
Because that's the effect that a war has.
Sure.
So Chiro Honda was demoted in his own company from president to senior managing director.
Oh, my gosh.
Because Toyota had a 40% stake in it for a while.
Wow.
So
Wait. Toyota had a 40% stake in what would have been, well.
Tokai Seki.
Okay. Yeah. That's not really the Honda Motor Company. So
that's not the Honda Motor
Company. I got you. Okay.
Yeah. And so, as they were working toward these wartime efforts, they were doing so under heavy direction by, you know, one of the largest companies in Japan at the time and the Japanese government. So already, when the earthquake and when the bombing strike, he's had a rough couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, that would slump anybody's shoulders, I guess. I mean, that's pretty humbling to have somebody walk in and take over your company, really,
and tell
you how to run things. That's got to be something that's tough.
But he perseveres, right?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, after World War II, really he wasn't producing rings anymore, obviously, because, you know, his company was factories gone and, you know, the contracts had dried up. And of course, you know, after World War II, there wasn't as much work as there was before. And there's the country is just war ravaged.
The economy's in shambles.
Exactly. It's kind of a burnt out shell of a country at that point in most places, anywhere that had been hit. And so, you know, he thinks, well, what can I do to kind of follow up on my success of the piston ring company?
Yeah. And, what can I do to not give up?
Yeah. And he still had some collateral left from, you know, some money left over from the company. And, you know, what was he going to do with the remnants of the company, the machining or whatever? And, he decided that he was going to start kind of playing around with engines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is true, because he started, playing around with engines. Specifically, he had about 500 two-stroke 50cc things called Tohatsu radio generator engines.
Okay, and those are like military surplus engines, right?
Right. Yeah, those are spoils of war.
Yeah, they were from what would they be from, like scooters and things like that, I would guess.
Yeah, and he founds the Honda Technical Research Institute in 1946.
Yeah, 1946. So we're edging up on the date when Honda Motor Company is first introduced to the world, really.
Yeah.
So 1946, he's built this thing, and it's called the Honda Technical Research Institute, and it's about 165 square meters of floor space in this, and it's big, like a factory type situation,
yeah,
I guess.
You know,
where it's a research and development area, really.
Yeah, let's just say that the name is kind of highfalutin for the physical location.
Yeah, yeah, and he's got 12 employees. So he starts out this Honda Research Institute with 12 employees, and what they're doing is their focus is on internal combustion engines, motorcycles in particular, because you know they're attaching these little engines to, at the time they're attaching them to bike frames,
right?
Which is not uncommon at the time. A lot of people were doing that. It's a way to mobilize the country, really.
Yeah. So here's how that would work. You are customer, you know, Jane Doe or John Doe, and you have your conventional bicycle, you could buy an engine from someone like Honda Technical, and they would give you instructions to attach this engine to your chain on your bicycle, or to attach, or they would attach it for you for, you know, a nominal fee.
Sure, yeah, but it was a way to get everybody on the move again, because, you know, like we said, it was a bad time in Japan. I mean, there were just, other transportation was in complete chaos at the time.
Sure.
So this was a way for people to regain some mobility. And, you know, they used these leftover engines from the war effort in order to kind of do that. And there was a huge demand for them, as you can imagine, right?
Yeah, and they also had to save, this is a very important point, it's going to come up later, they also had to save some of these engines for themselves to reverse engineer.
Understood, yeah, because we said that they were tearing down and trying to determine how to make them more efficient. They had focused, you know, all these 12 employees had focused on how to make them better. It's like taking a good idea and making it better. And so they created this chimney engine design initially. And then they created what they called the A-type engine, which was a two-cycle half horsepower engine that was really kind of the first thing, and it was nicknamed Beta Beta, I think is what they called it for the sound that it makes when they run it. It reminds me of the Harley potato
yeah,
thing,
yeah.
It
only makes it only makes sense if you if you're willing to embarrass yourself from listening to us on the air, just try the noise. Just say it softly, kind of like a bata, 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 bata.
Yep. Over and over again. You have to do it, and otherwise, and then you'll kind of understand exactly how this sounds. Now, they were extremely popular, these A-type engines.
Yes.
And it was, man, I think it was all the way until, 1948 they were building these things, right?
Right. And then they get to the point where they say, hey, you know what? Instead of just making engines for people to put on their own bicycles, what if we make the frame as well?
Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in late 1948. And that's the founding. This is the start of the Honda Motor Company. And they formed, again, Honda Motor Company Limited. They employed about 20 people initially. Mm-hmm. So it was a company that started with just 20 individuals. And, again, it was, you know, because of the success of this A-type engine that they had. And, there were about, man, I think there were something like, you know, based on the success that Honda Motor Company had with this engine in 1948 or up to 1948, it kind of spawned this whole influx of motorcycle manufacturers into that one city, into Hamamatsu City. There were something like 40 other motorcycle manufacturers that were in that city alone. So the competition was incredibly fierce.
From day one. Really.
Yeah. I mean, they were developing new and better engines all the time. Of course, Honda's seems to be on top of the things. You know, they're developing even better and even more efficient engines than everybody else. And that's what proved to be, you know, the best for them is that, you know, they went on to develop new products as well, because they moved on to the B type in 1948, mm-hmm. the C type in 1949, which is let's see, it's almost twice as powerful as the A type engine was originally. So, you know, in just 3 years, they've doubled the power on the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, it was a half horsepower to begin with, so they jumped up to one horsepower by the time they got to the C type, and then they went on to create the D type, I think. In 1949. So, you know, they're moving on, they're progressing, and, you know, these are all still two-cycle engines around, I think the D-type even, we're all the way up to like the 3-horsepower, you know, 98cc, so these are tiny engines, but,
yeah.
They called this one, they called the D-type engine the Dream.
The Honda Dream.
Yeah, the Dream. And that's a moniker that kind of hung on for a long time for several of the Honda engines.
Mm-hmm.
Soichiro named it that because he felt his dreams had come true with this thing because, you know, this is making him wildly successful.
Yeah, and what's interesting also about the name is a little sidebar here about Soichiro Honda. He was apparently kind of a guy with his head in the clouds for a little while.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, especially, you know, that happens a lot with inventors or anybody who's kind of a visionary. I just enjoyed that his wife's quotation. She said that he was a wizard at hardly working.
A wizard at hardly working? Oh, is that a backhanded compliment or what?
She must have been angry about
something. Yeah, I guess so. That's funny.
But beforehand, he had bounced from different jobs, working as mechanic, a race car driver, even a distiller. Now, this was all before he took over that old factory in 46. And
so this is before he's focused.
The whole time he's pursuing this dream. So, of course, he's going to name the Model D.
So before he really focused on what he was doing, before he really kind of buttoned down and said, I'm going to go this direction, she said he's a wizard at hardly working.
I think, you got to be really careful if you ever comment on somebody's family life. It's just a quotation, but I like to think that the entire time he still kind of had that smell of oil in his head, and I mean, if we're going to be a little bit sappy about it, in his heart.
Agreed.
I'm just saying, though, people may have discounted him this moment, just to underline how big the production of the Honda Dream is, the Model D, is the moment where, as you said, is dreams come true, and that's not just fluff.
Yeah, no. I mean, and this is kind of, this is years into it. So, he said, I've realized my dreams at this point, and this is in 1949. So, and this guy, he lived a long, long time. So, he saw this company grow exponentially over the years. I mean, in every year, really, from all the way from the beginning, from 1948 all the way through, today, really. Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't see it through today. We'll talk about that later. But anyways, we mentioned that they were the first motorcycle manufacturer to build the engine and the frame, too. Mm-hmm. Now, that's something unique, and I hadn't really thought about that prior to this point, but a lot of companies were receiving engines from other manufacturers and putting them on their own frame, or they were, vice versa. And no one was really building the whole thing from start to finish in their own factory under their own roof. And Honda was really the first one to do that, and that made them extremely efficient and successful, because it cut down on a lot of the transportation costs, shipping 100 engines a day to, X factory over there and having them put them on their frame and then assemble a bike and sell it. So it was a big time money saver. It just made complete sense to do it that way.
And with that, we will return to our ongoing show here, the story of Honda's origin story.
Yeah. Are we overstating our pull on
our
the internet?
Cachet.
Yeah, maybe we are. Anyway, so let's get back to Honda. You're right. So we're in 1949, and another guy joins the company, and he's actually credited with founding the company, which I find kind of strange, but he steps mm-hmm. in early in the company. His name is Takeo Fujisawa. Mm-hmm. And in October of 1949, he leaves a lumber company or a lumber industry that he was running. So he had a, great big executive position. I don't know what role he played in the lumber company, but he left this to become a managing director at Honda. And I guess the goal that Soichiro and Takeo talked about was that they wanted Honda to become a worldwide company.
Right. And Takeo Fujisawa is often acknowledged as the sales strategist of Honda. One of the things that he said, which is some advice I've heard before in an unrelated situation, he said the company's policy should be to face the toughest challenges first, mm-hmm. which is great advice to give, horrible advice to hear, and which usually defines it as great advice.
Yeah, it is good advice, probably. Yeah. So, and things move quickly, from this point. So Ooh. We're talking, he arrives in October of 49. By March of 1950, so just a few months later, they open up a Tokyo office. So, again, that's the capital city. They're in Tokyo. And by March of 1951, the Tokyo factory started production. So they're building engines and motorcycles and, they're just building motorcycles at this point and engines. They're not building cars at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They started with something like 300 motorcycles per month. And 2 years later, Ben, and by 1953, I think, they were building 1,000 motorcycles per month at the Tokyo factory.
And selling them like hotcakes.
Yeah. They were, every one of them was sold. It was definitely a popular item. And this is during the time when, the Korean War is going on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that's happening at this time. Oh, yeah, you know what? We need to say this. Production had switched over to four-cycle engines in the early 1950s because customers thought that, the two-cycle engines were a little too loud, a little too smoky.
Sure.
They feared that they would seize up a lot of times because, you don't get the proper mix in there, and they mm-hmm. do seize up. Anybody that owns a chainsaw or something like mm-hmm. that knows that.
They were a little too bata-bata, if you will.
That's a good way to put it. So, by the early 1950s, they had moved on from two-cycle engine to four-cycle engines.
Mm-hmm.
And then early 1950s, 1951, they produced another one of their dream engines, which is called the E-Type.
Mm-hmm.
And that was already up to 5.5 horsepower, a four-cycle overhead valve, 146cc engine. It's kind of a big step for them, big move.
Mm-hmm.
It accelerated well. I mean, it had this real high status among people in the motorcycle market. It was just a high performance engine. I know 5.5 horsepower doesn't sound like a lot, but at the time, that's considered a high performance engine. It's efficient and it was reliable.
Yes. And if we're okay, stop me if I'm going forward too fast. I want to get to the late 50s.
Sure.
Okay. The Honda Super Cub motorbike debuts.
Okay. Let's talk about it.
First, it's awesome, and that's the main thing I want to say. Second, it took sixth place in its class at the Isle of Man TT in 1959.
No kidding.
Uh-huh, and that's the same year that Fujisawa gets his wish and taking, again, his own advice to say tackle the toughest challenge first, 1959 is the year that Honda attempts to penetrate the U.S. market.
All right. So they decided that, you know, it's time to move on, time to go overseas, I guess, right? And they developed their first U.S. dealership in 1959. Mm-hmm. And they're still not making cars, Ben. They're just making engines.
Just motorcycles.
Engines and motorcycles. And I know a lot of people find that hard to believe, but I've always thought of this. I've always thought that Honda is as an engine factory or an engine builder that mm-hmm. happens to make automobiles. And, and I guess it's not that far off now that I think about it because, you know, I'd always seen Honda engines on other power equipment, you know, on leaf blowers.
Sure.
And
small lawnmowers.
Yeah, lawnmowers and water pumps and all kinds of things. It was everywhere. And of course, you know, four wheelers and other things like that and outboard motors or whatever. But I always thought of them as an engine company that happens to build cars. And it's not too far off, really.
Yeah. And here's the thing that happens when they're in the United States. All is not well or peachy keen in the very beginning. They're trying to save money. They send just a small group of people to the West Coast of the United States with their planning division chief, Kihachiro Kawashima. And these guys need to save money, Scott. So they share a one-bedroom apartment. They're stacking their motorcycle crates by hand in the warehouse. And the problem is that the Honda Dream motorcycles just seem a bit too fragile for the sustained high speed and long distance that Americans want.
Ah, so it's a different type of riding here in the United States.
Different type.
I got it. So they had to adapt, right? So they started building all kinds of different motorcycles. They mm-hmm. said, well, in order to fit that market, we're going to have to figure out how to change our product, our current product. And that's what they do. And they build so many different types of motorcycles. Ben, I can't even begin to read the list of motorcycles that they have. I tried to print it out. It was several pages long.
Yeah.
I mean, literally hundreds of different types of motorcycles that, you know, have gone in and out of production through the years, throughout the many, many years, decades, I guess.
Sure.
And they finally figured out that, you know, in Europe, we're going to have to come up with this type of mm-hmm. motorcycles.
Because people in Europe want this type of drive.
Exactly. And the same thing for the United States and the same thing for Japan. They already had the Japan angle figured out. You know, and here's what we're going to do when we go to India. You know, it's going to be completely different for every country, every continent that we approach.
Yes. And I want to tell a little bit of an addendum here to the story on the West Coast. Okay. So their Honda Dream motorcycles, this is how they figured out that you might not be able to make one bike for the entire world. Mm-hmm. Then the Honda Dream's not doing as well as they thought it would, and they were lucky enough to have borrowed $1 million from the Japanese Ministry of Finance, right? Mm-hmm. And they thought, oh, we're going to burn through it with nothing to show, the shame and embarrassment. But it turns out what people were more interested in the States were the little 50cc Honda Super Cub cycles that the team was using to run errands, you know, to like pick up sandwiches and stuff.
Yeah. Now these are the ones are these the F type engines that you're talking about? The little, the ones that said white tank, red engine. That was the tagline, I guess, in these.
Uh-huh.
Now in just a few months, they sold 25,000 of these things. So some of these were sold overseas, but a lot of them were sold in Japan. But this Cub F type engine was apparently wildly successful. I mean, again, 25,000 sold mm-hmm. in just a few months. That's amazing. So this company is running on whatever's popular at the time, but they're able to adapt to it almost immediately. They're saying, like, you know, or they're creating this, really. They're saying, here's our next new product, and that becomes what's popular.
Yeah, and they had other taglines like the Thrifty Nifty Honda 50, which a lot of people in our audience will probably remember. The Honda 50 is often called the two-wheeled Model T.
Hmm, interesting. I can see why. So, you know, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Getting derailed.
No, that's all right. I think we've talked about that they're here in the United States at mm-hmm. this point. They're wildly successful motorcycle manufacturers, engine manufacturers, of course. You know, I want to say that, just so I get this out there, because I know I'll forget it if I don't. I'm looking at the note right now. Up until, since 1959, Honda's been the world's largest manufacturer of motorcycles since 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a record that they still hold. They're also the world's largest manufacturer of internal combustion engines by volume. They produce today, Ben, 14 million engines each year.
It's crazy.
14 million engines. So going from, you know, these tiny little factories that we talked about in Hamamatsu.
Yeah.
All the way up to, you know, worldwide production, which, and I've got a list of facilities here in front of me too. And I can quickly run through them, but there's several of these places that are building these things. Again, 14 million engines a year. They're building them in Japan, India, United States, Canada, Mexico, United Kingdom, Belgium, Argentina, Brazil, China, Colombia, Thailand, Turkey, Malaysia, Philippines, Pakistan, Vietnam, France, Italy, and I think there's even more than that.
Wow.
So, you know, they're definitely a worldwide company, which is what they wanted in 49 when they brought in Fujisawa.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, that was the goal.
Yeah.
They achieved that in spades, made that goal a reality. They've become, they've become a big seller, but not the best sellers. I was looking up best seller numbers for U.S. and Japan.
Yeah.
And I've got numbers here from, I think it's up to 2013, 2012 in some cases. But in Japan, the best-selling car right now is a Toyota Corolla. And I don't think that Honda's ever been a bestseller in Japan or in the United States. I don't believe that has ever come up. I've tried to look in the records. I couldn't figure it out.
Ooh.
But, I mean, the Corolla sold something like 40 million cars worldwide since its production, all the way through July of 2013.
And the Honda Civic and Accord, we'd be remiss if we didn't say this, are so very ubiquitous in U.S. culture.
Yeah, they're huge. Now, I do want to say that the best-selling vehicle in the United States is still, and I think a lot of people already know this, but it's the Ford F-Series truck from something like 1948 until now. That's when they've been building it. For 28 consecutive years, however, it's been the number one selling vehicle in the United States. It's tough to unseat that one. That's a difficult one to beat. But you mentioned the Civic and the Accord, right?
Yes.
The Civic is it's obviously a brand bestseller for Honda. They do well with that. They've sold something like.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go on.
They do very well with that one. How about that?
Yeah.
They've sold over 16.5 million of those things up until my numbers only go to 2006. So there's another 7 years of production on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been around since 1972.
Oh, another, this is a bit more of a dubious record for a while there. I think it was the Honda. It was either the Civic or the Accord was one of the most stolen cars in the United States.
Which goes with the big numbers, right?
Right.
You build a lot of them, a lot of them are going to be stolen, I guess. So, you know, that makes sense.
Spoiler alert for our Grand Theft Auto episode.
Yeah, these stolen cars number usually matches the highest production number.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way that works. Now, the Honda Civic is approaching 42 years of production at this point.
Wow.
It's been around since 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surpassed the Model T in production years, because that was 1908 to 27. That was 19 years of production. And the Volkswagen Beetle is still on top of that with 65 years of production between 1938 and 2003, the original Beetle. So, wildly successful brands. Now, that came from one car, and I do think that we need to mention the first car that they brought over here to the United States. I think that's important to mention, because they didn't start building cars until 1963.
Right, and that's when they released the S500 in Japan.
Exactly, and that's the first production car from Honda. It was a two-door roadster, which is it was really kind of a neat-looking car. It looked like really is something that you wouldn't guess came from Honda. I mean, looking at what Honda produces today,
yeah,
I guess. You know, in a way, I guess I could see it from the S2000 model, I guess, similar to that, you know, two-door roadster.
Mm-hmm.
However, this S500, which is part of that line, it does follow that line, oddly enough. Two-door roadster kind of looks a lot like the MG Midget did during that day.
That's a good point, yeah.
Developed in the, I guess, kind of via their motorcycle expertise, right? So it had this 531cc dual overhead cam inline four engine, 44 horsepower, which is not fantastic, but again, about the right size for a small roadster like that.
Yeah.
1,500 pounds, top speed was 80 miles per hour, and the price tag, Ben, $1,275 in 1963, and I did the conversion.
Oh, okay, lay it on me.
All right. $1,275 in 1963 is equal to $9,629.65 in 2013.
That's a bargain.
That is a bargain. So this was one of those cars that came on the market and everybody's like, wow, a car for $1,200, I can afford that. And, you know, just the same way if a car were to come on the market now and be under $10,000, it's the exact same thing to say, yeah, that's, I'll take that.
And, let us not forget that the very next year in 64, Honda enters Formula One.
Yeah, that's crazy. So here's a car company that's, and of course they're building engines, right?
Right.
They just started building cars in 1963, and I'm so glad you mentioned that because, you know, they've got this long list of car models that they make now and racing cars and concept cars and everything. But for a car company to start in 63 and in 1964 start racing in Formula One, that's unheard of.
Yeah, if you're not Sachiro Honda.
Yeah, I guess. Now, they're providing engines, of course, for companies. You know, like I say, they put it on a Brabham chassis.
Yeah.
So they may put it on a different chassis, and they're producing the Formula One engine. They're also producing Formula Two engines at the time, and that was wildly successful. I don't think the Formula One cars were as successful as the Formula Two cars. There were some beautiful Formula One cars, no doubt.
Right, yeah. They win their first F1 victory in 1965 in Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. And in 1966 in Formula 2, they had a successful year. They had 11 wins for a Honda engine. They had a 1,000cc engine that they were producing for Formula 2. And that was even more successful than Formula 1. But the Formula 1 cars get all the press and all the excitement.
Sure, yeah.
And they were beautiful designs. If you've never seen the Honda Formula 1 cars, well, you know what? Check out our blog because there's a blog post there, and that happens to be one of my favorite F1 cars from a post that I'd written, I don't know, a month ago at this point.
Yeah, and you can check that out on our brand new website. I feel like we're those kids who finally grew up enough to have our own room in the house.
That's right.
Our website is carstuffshow.com, and that's just one of the awesome blogs on there.
Yeah, and you know what? That'll give you an idea of what some of these Honda entries into Formula One and Formula Two look like. But the Formula One cars were Honda cars as well. Man, they've got just so many different concept vehicles. I know we're kind of running long on this one, so maybe we don't need to go into all this. But man, they've got just a huge long list of current vehicles that they produce. I mean, think about like cars like the Prelude that are gone now. You know,
yeah.
that car was always fascinated me. There were some cars with four-wheel steering.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of advancements and you know what? They kind of took some of those advancements into a different direction with the Acura brand.
Yes. My favorite, being the Acura NSX from 1990.
Definitely my favorite as well. Now, some people might not know this, but the Acura brand has only been around since 1986. And it was really kind of a move that no one really expected because they were the first Japanese automobile manufacturer to release a dedicated luxury brand, which nobody really thought that Honda would ever have a luxury brand.
Right. Especially if you keep in mind that they were selling ever since the days when they were just attaching engines to bikes, their method was to have a consistent and consistently affordable thing, not a high-dollar fancy, for lack of a better word.
Not something vehicle. That's going to be competing with Lincoln and Cadillac and, you know, those makes and things like that. But this is that's what Honda is doing with the Acura brand. So, you know, I understand what they were doing. They had to shift direction and it ended up being successful for them. Obviously the Acura brand is still around, still doing very well.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that NSX is maybe one of my favorites. And, you know, there have been a lot of concept cars that have come from Honda that then turn out to be Acura branded vehicles when they arrive on the showroom floor.
On the shores, yeah. You know what's weird, Scott? What we might have to do? We might have to part two this. We might have to come back just to talk about the models and the racing. And
I didn't really think about that when I started this. Now I know we had so much about the founder and all that. We didn't really get into the current models or any of that stuff or any of the advancements or anything. But the story, the history behind where this company came from is so fascinating to me that, you know, it derives itself from these tiny little two-stroke engines that were attached to bicycles. And now we're talking about, you know, a major powerhouse in the world, in the automotive world.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows it. It's a household name.
Sure.
It's known worldwide. Very successful brand. And it's exactly what these guys wanted. They had that vision right from the beginning in the 1940s.
Well, let's call this then the Honda origin story, maybe. And we'll end where Sachiro Honda ends. So in 1989, Sachiro Honda is inducted into the U.S. Automotive Hall of Fame. At this time, he is 82 years old.
A prestigious award.
Prestigious award, the first person from any Asian country to be inducted into that Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. So historic as well as prestigious. He's also had medals created in his name, such as the Sichiro Honda Medal, that is given to recognize outstanding achievements or contributions to the field of personal transportation.
Makes sense.
He's a member of the Order of the Rising Sun.
Ah, I did read about that. That's interesting.
And with these and many other accolades.
He's a top member in that as well. He's one of the upper echelon members of that Rising Sun Order, I believe.
Yeah, senior third rank.
Yeah, very good.
And these are just a few of the awards that he personally acquired. Perhaps in a later episode we'll talk about all the awards that Honda's been racking up.
Sure.
And then in 1991, August 5th, Sichiro Honda passes away, leaving a legacy that continues today.
Yep, he was age 84. I think he died of liver failure, so it was something that was I guess beyond his ability to prevent at that point. And man, 84 years old. Not as long as I'm sure that, you know, he would like to have lived, of course. You know, he wanted a long, long life to enjoy all the success because he was working right up to the very end. I think he actually worked until 1973 when he retired. He officially retired in 73.
Mm-hmm.
But he came back on as a, get this, Ben, supreme advisor and director of the company. Supreme advisor. That's what his title was.
I mean, any job title with supreme in there is pretty cool.
And he hung around until about 1983 doing that. So, you know, he was only officially, I mean, fully retired, I guess, for about 8 years before he passed away. So, you know, I didn't really get a chance to completely live out, you know, all the things that he probably wanted to do post mm-hmm. you know, employment, I guess. But I guess he was kind of wild even in that. He was into hang gliding, ballooning, skiing.
Yeah.
He was still kind of into, like, oddly enough, into kind of like adrenaline sports almost.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes sense, I guess, with, you know, the beginnings of this company, you know, that he was just this dreamer guy, this guy that, he was a wizard at not working or whatever you said. What was that?
Hey, I didn't say that.
Yeah, his wife said that. That's right. But, what a fascinating guy, fascinating company. And, man, we are going to have to come back with part two. This has already gone too long.
Yeah, well, this is a Honda origin story, so stay tuned for part two. Before we get out of here, Scott, I've got some listener mail for you. Okay, so Will from Newcastle, Australia writes in to tell us, "Hey guys, I thought you may be interested in a few other things about road trains from an Australian native."
Very interested.
He said, "I have never driven road trains, but I do drive trucks over the summer out west, and I have some experience with them." First, he said, now this is long, so I'm just going to hit the highlights. First, he said, as you can probably imagine, they go through a huge amount of fuel. By the time you get out into the outback where they're common, it might be 1,000 kilometers between fuel stations, so they have enormous tanks to make up the distance. When you stop at one of the stations, you'll notice high-flow fuel bowsers. They're fuel hoses that fit onto the tanks on each side of the truck. The fuel hoses are about the size of a fire hose.
Wow.
So it doesn't take drivers an hour to fill up. If you fill a regular 4x4 with these, it'll be full in about 10 seconds if you can get the nozzle into the tank.
Oh, my gosh. That's an amazing amount of fuel.
All right. So there's another one. He says, drafting or overtaking. While road trains do travel very quickly, you will often want to overtake. It's a strange procedure because they're so long and you're traveling so fast, it can be almost impossible to see around them. You don't want to begin overtaking a 100-foot road train traveling 130 kilometers an hour, only to find out halfway through that there's an oncoming 100-foot, 150T road train traveling toward you.
Oh my gosh, that's where you quickly hit the brakes and then duck in behind it, right?
Yeah, that reminds me of a very scary game of Frogger or something.
Yeah, it sounds terrifying.
Yeah, the one time, here's one, roadkill. The one time that you don't want to overtake them is around dusk or after dark. You would not believe the amount of wildlife, kangaroos, emus, goats, that will be on the road out there. I wouldn't be exaggerating if I said you may pass big groups of these animals every 10 to 50 meters. They will totally destroy your car if you hit them at any kind of speed. You'll be stuck in the desert overnight. Without a truck ahead of you, you'll be forced to travel, say, something 30 to 50 kilometers an hour to avoid having accidents.
So you're better off just kind of riding in the draft at dark, after dark, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Because road trains are so big, with big bull bars and big lights, it's very safe to travel right behind them. They will literally plow a path for you. Sometimes the guys don't even slow down and will just continue to travel at 130 kilometers an hour. With so much weight, they have no way of stopping.
Interesting story.
So usually you can reach the driver over the radio and explain that you would like to follow them into the next town, and they'll slow down.
Ben, this whole thing, I mean, everything about road trains is fascinating to me. I mean, even like the fueling thing is interesting, mm-hmm. that, you know, they fuel it with something the size of a fire hose. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like almost like race car when they fuel up the race car, how quickly that happens, right?
Right, yeah.
The whole thing about, you know, just they continue on if they hit something because they're so big, so massive, it's harder to get them going again, right?
Mm-hmm.
The overtaking, that's amazing because, I mean, who has the guts to do that, I guess, especially at night, like this listener
yeah.
says. Even during the day, that's a dangerous maneuver.
Sure.
You know, for fear of another one coming the other way.
Mm-hmm. You can't see around it.
Yeah, just the sheer tonnage that these things haul.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a fascinating thing to see in action.
Oh, and you'll love this email, Scott, because I'm just hitting some of the high points.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just end it here with this one part. Will says, the road train drivers out west are truly professionals and will almost always help you out if need be. They're also very courteous, in my experience at least, because they realize their size. Thanks for the great podcast. It's always good to listen while I'm driving trucks 8 to 12 hours at a time through the summer or while I'm down on the tractor through the winter.
That is a long drive, so 8 to 12 hours a day driving. But, man, that's really cool. I'm glad to hear that, you know, the road train drivers are courteous, too, because I think that goes a long way when you're driving a vehicle that
mm-hmm.
size. I mean, you have to be courteous to other drivers. Otherwise, I guess you don't really have to, I suppose, if you're driving something that big, right?
Right. I guess you don't have to. It's just classic.
Yeah, it's just
dignified.
By choice.
And now, Scott, with that email, maybe we shouldn't feel so bad about going long on some episodes.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, this was a pretty long one. But
hopefully it was interesting.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll come back with a part two, I guess. Kind of a follow-up. Maybe not anytime soon. We don't have any plans to do it. We didn't have plans before this. So, man, we'll get to it, though.
Yeah, it'll be the modern Honda. In the meantime, this would be a perfect time for you guys to write to us and suggest some stuff Honda-related that you would like us to cover in more detail in an upcoming episode. Or, you know, just let us know what you think of Honda. Or if you have any suggestion for an upcoming episode, you can always shoot us a Facebook message. You can drop us a tweet on Twitter. Or you can send us an email directly. We are
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.